What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Unchurching, Healing Religious Trauma and Owning Your Spiritual Identity. I am your host, Titus Glenn, and this is the place where we talk about deconstructing faith, owning your spiritual identity, and healing religious trauma. Today's guest, Kelly Minter, we discuss again what is religious trauma as defined through her counseling lens, and we explore how to unlearn doctrine that no longer supports you. So stay tuned and join in on the conversation as we continue to unpack on this road of discovery in unchurching.
Find yourself, be yourself, and let others do the same. Find yourself, be yourself. Let others do the same. Find yourself, be yourself. And let others do the same. Find yourself, be yourself. And let others do the same.
All right, everybody. What's up? What's up? I hope you guys are doing well. Listen, we have such an amazing treat. As you guys are aware, we just transitioned this show from Safe Place with Titus Glenn to Unchurching, Healing Religious Trauma and Owning Your Spiritual Identity. And I found my guest today on YouTube talking about religious trauma. And I reached out to her and I just wanted to have this conversation just to bring more awareness to it, get her story behind it, and just really just see where the conversation takes us today to really support those that are actually walking through this phase of their life. So if y'all could please help me welcome Kelly Minter. Kelly, how are you today?
Hello. I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing really, really well. I'm so happy that you decided and took my invitation just to be on this show because, you know, I think a lot of people, let me just say my background from coming from church, I don't think people are aware of the topic of religious trauma, but I think it's definitely starting to make waves as people are, I would say, what they call now, I guess, deconstructing their faith.
Yeah.
They're having, you know, to figure out like what is really going on. So if you could share with us, let's just start it off by just if you could give religious trauma a definition, like how would you describe religious trauma?
That's a great question, because typically the response that I get to any of my religious trauma videos, it starts out with, I don't know if I have religious trauma, but, and then goes on to these things. And I'm like, how? My dear friend, how do you not know that is trauma? Like that's trauma, you know? And so I actually, in prepping for this, went searching for like a smarter sounding definition than mine, because mine is anything that comes directly from religion that doesn't sit right with who you are and your spirit and causes you harm, that's religious trauma. So so I went for a smarter one, which came from therapist.com. So this one is, it's not all that different. So I'll give myself a little bit of smart credit, but occurs when a person's religious experience is stressful, degrading, abusive, or damaging. And because it's such a personal experience, it's different for everybody. So somebody can go through something or have something said to them at church or, you know, spoken from a pulpit or even just that implied, like a sort of insidious implication of who we're supposed to be and when, even that implication piece can affect different people different ways. And so what might end up being really damaging to someone emotionally might bounce off of someone else because they weren't in a zone to sort of internalize that, you know, which makes it very individualized and very difficult to point to and say all the time, this is religious trauma. If it's not something that we also know to be traumatic, assault, that kind of stuff. Right. Like we know these are traumas.
Absolutely.
But for people who have not been assaulted or who have been convinced that the assault wasn't an assault for different reasons, that it gets blurry and it gets confusing. And part of the difficulty of religious trauma is when it comes from your religion, you're taught not to question it. Mm-hmm. And so if it comes from them, how could it possibly be bad? And even if you walked away from your religion, even if you're not religious anymore, sometimes those pieces still stay because the training is so deep.
So with that right there, because I know that even in my own research, it is really predicated based upon your own individual experience. But mm-hmm. if you could give us an example of what that looks like in your practice and maybe some things that you've seen so that if someone is watching or listening, they can maybe, you know, try to identify where that where it resonates with them.
Yeah. So one of the things that I see a lot is self-esteem issues, because when you go to a religious institution that really steeps itself in purity culture. And this is the craziest part. I've had so many conversations with people, with men and women, about purity culture. And as a woman growing up, I saw purity culture to mean I am, my body itself is sinful, and therefore I have to cover it up because I might cause a man to sin. And that's my responsibility, right? And like, my worth is in my ability to attract a husband, to keep a husband, to keep him happy, and to bear children. And that's my worth. That's my entire role. And then, so I grew up also thinking that that's all men ever wanted from me. And then also men had it so easy because they didn't have those messages. And then in recent years, it's become very clear, because this is the other part, right? Then you've got this message that's out there to men, which to be manly and to be a man, you can't have emotions. You can't be upset by things. You're in charge of everything. You don't get any downtime. And your brain is garbage, because the same way that they taught us that men can't think about anything but sex, they also taught the men they can't think anything besides sex. And so they're like, oh, either I'm broken because I don't think about just sex, or I'm supposed to do that. And it's just, I'm just this gross individual that is supposed to be predatory because that's the only way I know how to be. And so like, not saying that every man does the things, but it gets in there to who you are. So that self-esteem piece, like you come out of it just assuming that you are garbage, because all the bad things you do in religion are on you, and all the good things go up there. Right. All the good things are like glory to God, but all the bad things are you being a sinner. The only thing you got is bad.
Yeah, that I can so identify with that, especially with me being a guy who has never really been into sports or having men around me. And even I was having, what am I trying to say? Because I have so many thoughts going on right now. Because to me, this subject is so complex, but it isn't. It's really like the idea of how men and women should show up even in a marriage. Because I, in this gesture of me really looking at religious trauma, really view toxic masculinity as religious trauma. Because when we go into a household of what we've been taught a household should look like, you know, if the woman is working, then the man is viewed as less than, versus teaching a partnership to see who is better at what. Right. Would you agree to that statement, that that is a form of religious trauma?
Absolutely. I think that the idea of the strong man head of household thing is like, it is so toxic, and it's toxic to men and to society. But like, we have this idea that like toxic masculinity means the man is toxic. And sometimes it's true, but that's not really the point. It's toxic to men internally, you know, like how they view themselves and understand their worth. And it drives a wedge between them and the partner they choose later. Because the idea of leaning on a partner is unmanly.
Yeah. And it also teaches, it kind of like, it almost teaches a level of codependency too.
Yeah.
Especially when you, when you look at men and women, how they interact, and a woman's supposed to be relying on a man, or that philosophy of, you know, a woman's places in the household, or a woman is not supposed to speak in church. It's preaches this level of, mm-hmm. I would even say self-esteem on women in that regards, as to yeah. I can't be heard or I'm the lesser vessel in mm-hmm. this space, when that may not necessarily be the case when it right. comes to, if you were to just teach finding out who you are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So can you share with us your journey in discovering religious trauma, whether you had it, or how did you come yeah. into the knowing of the terminology, et cetera?
So I'm going to try to make it as succinct as possible, because when I tried to write it down, when I was thinking it through, just to be like a little bit prepped for today, uh-huh. I was like, oh, that's a long one. So I grew up in a mainline denomination in America.
Okay.
And I realized, I heard my call into ministry, as we say,
for sure.
When I was a junior in high school, and I became a youth pastor. I went to college for youth ministry. It's a whole thing. I became a chaplain on campus. Like it was a whole thing. And then I actually left college 2 years in and started working in a church. Didn't really need at that point anyway, need a degree to do youth ministry. Mm-hmm. And so I did the things and went church to church. In 2004, I moved to Florida. Well, no, that's not true. In 2004, I moved to Florida. 2006, I moved to Jacksonville,
okay.
Northeast Florida. And that part is important because I can't say any more specifics about the church that I went to.
Okay.
So people can take their guess if they want to. But I went to a church and I was there for 15 years.
Mm.
And in the time that I was there is really, I think, the biggest like growth points for me. Emotionally, spiritually, like understanding the different levels of myself. I also in there somewhere, before I moved to Florida, I met the person who ended up becoming my wife. And that's a problem, because I don't know if you know this, but I'm a woman. So that's a problem for this denomination. And that's ultimately why I left. But, in the midst of all of that, it just started to feel so off. The things we're teaching people, and I stopped teaching things the way the church was teaching it. And it wasn't a problem for anybody because I was still getting kids in. And so like the numbers were still high. So they kind of let me do what I wanted. But next thing you know, I turn around and my whole youth group are feminists, queer kids, you know, like trans kids. And like, this is who I've gotten my youth group, activists in their high school. And like, so soon people start looking around. They're like, what's happening here? Like what's happening? And it was offensive to the people who started looking around because they wanted a different type of world changer.
For sure.
In fact, one of our boys won this, like, don't even get me started on fashion shows. And it was a fashion show for men because somehow that makes it not derogatory and difficult and ridiculous, but it was for charity at their high school. And he won it. And it was like a Mr. whatever, the town, name of the town, you know, so it was just a fashion show. It was like a beauty pageant for men. They're like, oh, but it's men, so it's not derogatory. Okay, whatever. But it all went to charity. Like the person who won got their pick of a charity, and he was one of our leaders in our youth group and sent all his money to Planned Parenthood. When I tell you, my phone did not stop ringing for 3 days. I'm not even kidding, because then the school was like, no, you can't do that. And people from our church like, no, you can't do that. And I was like, absolutely he can. And he said, absolutely I can. And it was a whole thing. But that was the kind of kid I ended up in with my youth group for years.
Wow.
And even during that, like they taught me so much about how people were seeing feminism now. Mm. And like one of the president of the Young Feminist Club was in my youth group too. And she said that they had just started like a new sector kind of group, and a couple of men showed up. And there were a bunch of people there who were like, this is ridiculous. Like, no, you can't have men here. And she's like, well, yeah, we can. And I was like, tell me, like, we were in Cuba, actually, on a trip to meet a house church that we were helping to fund in Cuba. We're just sitting around this like picnic table outside and talking. And I was like, well, tell me about that. Like, what was that? What do you mean? And she's like, well, as women, we know what that gender oppression feels like. And if we have men who want that to not be the case anymore, how can we, if we tell them, no, they can't come in,
right,
then we're doing the same thing when we have an opportunity to teach instead. And I was like, holy cow. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you do. And I just never heard it phrased like that. And this is one of my high schoolers that's talking to me. And I'm like, man, I swear I learned more from those kids than I think I've ever taught anybody else in my life. But anyway, so in all of that, I had one of the girls who was just really felt very weighed down by this image and understanding society wise, like she's supposed mm-hmm. to be pretty and thin and like, you know, have big boobs and whatever. And she also developed really early. She gets dress coded all the time at school. Mm-hmm. Like it was really these like multiple different worlds she was living in and the kind of attention she was getting because of her figure. And anyway, she ended up with an eating disorder. And wow. I have long since asked her if I can tell this story. I will never say her name, but I asked because it's so instrumental to becoming who I was that I like, I'm like, is this, you know, she's very comfortable with me using it. So I'm just going to throw that out there. And she developed eating disorder. And we, as was my habit with some of my students, went like went on a walk on the beach because we're in a beach town. And it was winter. And I will never forget, I brought strawberries and animal crackers because somehow that became like my thing. And so what I brought to the beach with kids. And we just sat there and watched the waves and we talked. And she told me about a coach that was the one that got involved and told her mom. And I was like, wow, the coach had more courage and less interaction with this kid than I did.
Okay.
And I'm like, I didn't feel like I had the tools. So I decided to go to school for counseling, to be a counselor, not to like become private practice counselor necessarily at that point, but to have the tools to help the kids. I went to a grad school that is probably at this current stage, the biggest offender of Christian nationalism, of oppression of women, definitely wow. oppression of queer people. And that's where I went to school because they were cheapest and didn't require GRE. And I had been out of college for a long time at that point. I did go back and finish my undergrad because you need that to get into grad school. So I went to another school, and which was a fantastic college, also a Christian college, but had fantastic experience there. And they're like really instrumental in like equal rights and stuff. Like 2020 was just pivotal for them. They changed everything in 2020. It's been amazing to kind of see. So that school, Christian school, still, you know, absolutely doing what you'd think Christians should be doing. Anyway, my grad school, not so much.
Okay.
Went to the grad school, tend to not tell people where it is. It rhymes with Liberty. Keep that in if you want. And that's where I went to grad school. And I was like, so it's in the thick of it again. You know, I'm like in my face all the time, like the things that I shouldn't be doing and things I shouldn't be. And they weren't like women belong in the home Christians, but they were like, men are absolutely the right ones. And white Christian rich men are the only thing that's going to save this world. Wow. And everyone else is secondary. And I'm like, awkward, feels weird. And it's what they believed. And I don't know how many people know about the story of Jerry Falwell and what happened with him a couple of years ago. I have a video about it on my channel if you want to go see. But anyway, all of this sort of unraveled. The college was unraveling, the leadership was unraveling, the churches started unraveling because the denomination I was working on was starting to have a split between whether or not people wanted to ordain, essentially affirm people in the queer community. At this point, I'm not out to my job still. For most of my life, I wasn't. And in fact, when I lost that job, I lost two jobs in the span of a month because people had every reason to assume, because my wife has been in my life since I was 17. So like, it's kind of like, duh, but I never said it because if I didn't say it, I couldn't get in trouble for it. Right. But like pastors who would come in and ask me questions about our relationship and like the nature of our relationship. And I'm just protecting you so nobody gets upset. That kind of stuff was said to me a lot. And like it, so it was like such a gradual, like, this is not okay. The way that I go about the world is dictated by your misunderstanding of scripture. And that's not okay. And I'm looking at all of these kids who are like amazing leaders in their community and everything. Right. And like that one kid, he had a newspaper article written about him. And do you know what didn't come up in his newspaper article?
What?
His participation in his church.
Wow.
All the things he did and no one mentioned it. And do you know why? because that was not seen as something that would get, that would prove how good of a person he is anymore. Because people weren't looking at it that way anymore. And I was like, well, then I guess I don't have to look at it that way anymore either. Because it, like, there are still things today. I watched Shiny Happy People to do a video series on it. And there are still things there that I'm like, oh my God, like I never unlearned that either. You know, as much as I know I've done the work and I do the work with my clients and on the channel, there's still things that come up that are like, oh, hey, by the way, that indoctrination is not just gone because you don't live in it anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Like you said, you've said so many nuggets in this, in the story. I think one of the things that really intrigues me when we're talking about this type of just trauma and it being religious is that I don't think people are aware of how we develop as humans.
Yeah.
And so in this developmental, in the developmental stages, to really teach that there is only one way from the time we could talk.
Right.
Is really, really interesting that people don't combat it until they start to, until we start to see the world.
Right.
So can you share with us, like, how does one take the steps to start unlearning? Because with that in mind, I believe they call it the development of faith. And I'm 41 right now. And I'm, like you said, like I'm starting to really unlearn. But like you said, it still comes up. Can you kind of walk those that are listening, like how do you start to take the steps to actually unlearn some of the doctrines that no longer serve you? Now, that is our show, everybody. You have been listening to Unchurching, and I am your host, Titus Glenn. Listen, join us as we continue this conversation same time next week. And if you haven't done so already, make sure you follow me on all social media outlets under Titus Glenn Official. Until then, take care, and you guys have an amazing day or evening whenever you're watching this. I love you guys. All right, till then.
Find yourself, be yourself, and let others do the same. Find yourself, be yourself, and let others do the same. Find yourself, be yourself, and let others do the same. Find yourself, be yourself. Let others do the same.